I have already indicated earlier this evening that Lewis wrote a good deal about the nature of education in his book, The Abolition of Man. I was delighted to hear that Dr. Grinke mentioned this in her lecture, and I suspect it may be the subject of some discussion during our next speaker's talk. But being the educator and master teacher that he was, Lewis's thoughts on the subject of education were by no means limited to this particular series of lectures. Lewis argued for the importance of a liberal arts education at the outset of Britain's involvement in World War II in his famous essay, Learning in Wartime. And if you're interested in that essay, you can find it in a collection entitled The Weight of Glory and Other Addresses. And over the course of his career in the Academy, Lewis would produce a number of fascinating and provocative essays on the nature, purpose, and limits of education, especially in the arts and letters. And of course, that makes sense given his academic training. Among these provocative and fascinating essays, perhaps the most provocative, at least in my mind, was an essay entitled Democratic Education, first published in April of 1944. Borrowing from Aristotle, Lewis argued that the kind of education that was necessary for the preservation of democracy is not necessarily the kind of education that Democrats, and by that term he simply meant those who favor total equality or egalitarianism, not our modern day Democrats, he said that the education that was necessary for the preservation of democracy is not necessarily the kind of education that those who favor total equality would want. Lewis feared in this essay that the pressure to use education as a means of achieving perfect equality of outcome among every member of society, that is to ensure that every member of society is equally educated, would have two results. First, he worried that it would result in a reduction of education to the lowest common denominator. And second, he also worried that it would result in a loss of genuine diversity in the gifts of human nature. Lewis believed that genuine education required a sensitivity to the particular gifts of each student, not the requirement that every student fit in the same exact mold. Thus, he explained in this essay that the young boy who loves to whittle on a piece of wood with his pocket knife should not be forced to receive educational credits for this hobby in a wood carving class, just so that he can receive a college degree like his friend who studies classical Latin. Lewis thought that doing this sort of thing would simultaneously kill the value of a college degree, and, as importantly, he thought it would kill the joy of working with one's own hands. Sadly, these obscure and admittedly controversial ideas from the pen of C.S. Lewis have been largely neglected over the past 50 years. You have to really search if you want to find these essays. Perhaps a kind of recovery is indeed needed, one that will enliven our thinking about what education is really for. As Providence would have it, and perhaps some planning, our second speaker this evening will be addressing precisely this issue. Dr. Brad Green is Associate Professor of Christian Thought and Tradition at Union University. He's the author of several important books related to the topic of education and also to the history of Christian thought, the first of which is The Gospel and the Mind, Recovering and Shaping the Intellectual Life. He also has written a book on the theological work of Colin Gunton, an Augustine scholar. And most recently, I believe, or close to most recently, he has edited and contributed to the book Shapers of Christian Orthodoxy, Engaging with Early and Medieval Theologian. He has written articles for such journals as Touchstone, which is a journal of mere Christianity, an appropriate Lewis title, the Journal of International Systematic Theology, and the Chronicles, among others. Finally, a bit closer to home, Dr. Green is a co-founder of Augustine School, which is a private Christian liberal arts school here in Jackson, Tennessee. As someone who has thought not only extensively about the nature of education, but has also put those thoughts into practice, we are honored tonight to hear from Dr. Green this evening on C.S. Lewis and the recovery of true education. Will you join me in welcoming Dr. Brad Green?
Thank you, Professor Barnard. It is a pleasure to be here, and thank you for sticking around for the second hour. I am nursing a cold, so I don't have like a water bottle because I plan on exercising up here or anything, but I do want to keep hydrated as I try to work through this cold. So, and I can already tell it's going to be a little warm, so let me take this off. And Professor Grinke, thank you again for a great talk. I don't think I've heard you lecture before, and great to hear you, and great job. Fun to hear. Let's jump in. C.S. Lewis and the Recovery of True Education. Protestants do not venerate saints quite like our Roman Catholic friends do, but if Protestant evangelicals, at least those of a more conservative bent, do have a saint, it is, of course, C.S. Lewis. I suspect he's probably the choice. A different paper could explore the cultural and sociological phenomena concerning C.S. Lewis's revered place in the Protestant world, and particularly in the more bookish Protestant world and the world of the Christian college and university. C.S. Lewis, for good or for ill, he is our hero. In a sense, he is our saint. For me personally, and I suspect for many of us, C.S. Lewis was key to our own intellectual development. I still remember the first time I read the Chronicles of Narnia. It was an absolute adventure, a wonderful story. Through reading it, I became aware of the beauty of the Christian story as well as the power of the imagination. I remember the exact place I was sitting when I finished Mere Christianity as an undergraduate. I was on the third floor of my college library. I finished the last page and was absolutely of Mere Christianity and was absolutely stunned by the last few pages where Lewis talks about how God is forming and creating new men. That is, through properly relating to God the Father through his Son, we do in fact lose ourselves at one level, but it is only in losing ourselves that we truly become the persons we are meant to be. Indeed, until we lose ourselves, we are not in fact truly ourselves. We're not the persons we ought to be. What Lewis was for me, and still is a bridge to the Western intellectual tradition. Lewis has served as a conduit to this larger tradition, and particularly the central Christian insights of that tradition. Let me give an example. When I first read Mere Christianity, almost 30 years ago or so, which is hard to believe, I was impressed by how Lewis described the sinfulness of human persons. Man, Lewis said, was a bent creature. We were no longer straight or true. As sinful creatures, we are bent. Brilliant, I thought. Lewis is amazing. He comes up with these brilliant insights out of his own mind and his own mind alone. However, as I began to read theology and stumbled upon such greats like Augustine, I discovered that the notion of the sinner's will being bent is quite ancient, besides the Bible, being found in Augustine, as well as other seminal Christian thinkers. But while Lewis had not invented the notion of the sinner as a bent creature, he had mediated this terminology and concept to this young reader and eventually wannabe theologian. He was my main conduit to coming to terms with the Western intellectual tradition of which I was a part. And this leads to the heart of what I'd like to explore in the few minutes we have tonight. The insights and thought of C.S. Lewis in relationship to education. I've titled this talk, C.S. Lewis and the Recovery of True Education. Of course, the title presumes that there has been some sort of loss of true education in our day, and that something must be now recovered. I really won't be defending at length the notion that education in our day is in some sense lacking. I will be taking this as axiomatic. That could be another paper. I'll take you to coffee at Barefoot's if you want to talk about that. But I want briefly to sketch several insights or principles or a tendency from Lewis's work which might help us to think about the nature of education and might help us to think about the possibility of recovering true education in our day. And Professor Barnard is right. The abolition of man is central. I really have eight themes. The first four are from the abolition of man. The last four are from different works by Lewis. So theme number one, education and the truth of things. Education and the truth of things. The closest thing to a treatise on education from the pen of Lewis is his The Abolition of Man. A series of three lectures, Men Without Chests, The Way, and The Abolition of Man, originally published in 1944. The whole title of the book is The Abolition of Man or Reflections on Education with Special Reference to the Teaching of English in the Upper Forms of Schools. We can find a number of insights into the nature of education from this work. We'll draw out several. Now, on the truth of things, here's the heart of the matter for Lewis. Lewis is concerned to point out that in learning or in education, we are really coming into contact with the truth of things. There is a real world outside us. It is possible to come into contact with that world, to know it meaningfully, and to speak of it meaningfully. This may sound like common sense, and it is. Nonetheless, it was necessary for Lewis, and I think for us, to defend such a notion. And if you've had Dr. Barnard or me, you may have heard about this part of the book, the Green Book, and all that Lewis does. But in The Abolition of Man, Lewis begins by mentioning an English textbook, one which Lewis thinks will undermine true education. It's made for schoolboys. Lewis creates a name. He calls it the Green Book. He creates the names of the authors, Gaius and Titius, or gives them these names, so as to protect perhaps the not-so-innocent. In the Green Book, there is a passage describing a man looking at a waterfall. The man comments that the waterfall is sublime. Gaius and Titius, the authors of the textbook, comment, "What the man said, that is sublime." When the man said, "That is sublime," he appeared to be making a remark about the waterfall. Actually, he was not making a remark about the waterfall, but a remark about his own feelings. And this is key to the whole book. What he was saying was, really, I have feelings associated in my mind with the word sublime, or shortly, I have sublime feelings, end quote. Gaius and Titius conclude, we appear to be saying something very important about something, and actually, we are only saying something about our own feelings. Okay. And I don't know about you, but if you've read this, the first time you read it, it's very dense. So if Barnard's assigned it to you, just keep reading it until you get it, and it'll repay reading it, okay? Lewis is concerned to point out what might be obvious. If every time we say or think we are saying something about the world, we are really saying something about our own feelings, then an inevitable conclusion seems to follow. We don't actually experience anything outside of us, or at the least, we cannot say or know anything meaningful about the world outside of us. In short, if Gaius and Titius are correct, education is literally a very lonely business. For all we are doing in speaking is speaking about feelings or sensations in our own heads. We are cut off from all reality outside of us. And all of this in an English textbook, right? And Lewis is very good on this, how the kids think they're just doing English, but what are they doing? They're doing philosophy 101 from a certain perspective, right? But it's not just English that they're doing. All right. So this point leads to my next main insight from Lewis, who we are and who we ought to be. Second theme, who we are and who we ought to be. But this problem of knowing the world leads to increasing problems. For if when I speak of the waterfall, that is, it is sublime, I am only speaking about my own feelings, one is not only being cut off from things like waterfalls, I am being cut off from all value whatsoever. As Lewis suggests, if I cut my teeth on the Green Book, I will find myself making two conclusions. First, quote, all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about the emotional state of the speaker, end quote. And second, quote, all such statements are unimportant, end quote. And all of this is tragic, for the textbook writers have become, if even unwittingly, conditioners of the most profound sort. And these conditioners show up throughout the Abolition of Man. Lewis writes of Gaius and Titius, it is not a theory they put into his mind, but an assumption, which 10 years hence, its origin forgotten and its presence unconscious, will condition him to take one side in a controversy which he has never recognized as a controversy at all. The authors themselves, I suspect, hardly know what they are doing to the boy, and he cannot know what is being done to him. And Lewis does not mince words. Gaius and Titius, while teaching him nothing about letters, because Lewis thinks they're pretty bad at knowing their English as well, while teaching them nothing about letters, have cut out of his soul, long before he is old enough to choose, the possibility of having certain experiences which thinkers of more authority than they have held to be generous, fruitful, and humane. Lewis at points suggests that authors like Gaius and Titius are maybe simply a tad misled, and perhaps do not really know the damage they are doing. But there's another option, Lewis suggests. Maybe the Gaiuses and Titiuses of the world know exactly what they are doing. Lewis writes, the difference between us may go all the way down. They may really hold that the ordinary human feelings about the past or animals or large waterfalls are contrary to reason and contemptible and ought to be eradicated. They may be intending to make a clean sweep of traditional values and start with a new set. Okay. So, Lewis realizes that many of his peers are under the impression that their students need to be guarded from a weak excess of sensibility. But Lewis thinks the problem is of a different kind. The real problem is that students generally need to be awakened from the slumber of cold vulgarity. Indeed, Lewis notes, the task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. And here we're getting, I think, in a sense, the heart of the positive side of the Abolition of Man. And that is, what is education for? What is the goal of education? He continues, the right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. Okay? So if Gaius and Titius are trying to diminish or cut off the legitimacy of sentiments, the answer, Lewis says, is to cultivate proper sentiments in our students. Okay? He goes on, by starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey to the propagandist when he comes. For famished nature will be avenged, and a hard heart is no infallible protection against a soft head. And if you're a parent here, I see at least a few parents here, the rest of you, maybe one day parents, probably you will, when your children disobey you, you've got to be careful, because I see, and dads, you can give me an amen or something here. One of our first tendencies is to get angry at our children. And the anger is, you've got to be careful how you use your anger. But there's a proper sense in which we are terribly saddened when our children disobey. Why? Because we see the potential for our children to become radically less than they ought to be and can be. Right? It's not just they've crossed a moral line. You know, it's not like you didn't check off a list, check off and do this and not do that. It's you see your child becoming something ugly and scary when a child lies, when a child betrays your trust. You see the possibility of that child becoming something they ought not to be, right? And so we flare up. At least I do. Maybe the rest of you dads don't. But anyway, when I read Lewis on education, I can't help but think of child raising, because it's all one big project, really. Lewis turns to older understandings of learning and knowledge, understandings which are in danger of being lost. Lewis writes, "Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believe the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive, but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence, or our contempt." Lewis turns to Augustine, who could speak of the order of love, whereby the ordinate condition of the affections in which every object is accorded that kind and degree of love which is appropriate to it. And Aristotle makes an appearance here. The aim of education is to make people like and dislike what he ought. And if this is one reason I have students read this text, and I suspect it's what Barnard is doing, is we're engaging in a preemptive strike against modern culture and trying to save you. Have you read The Catcher in the Rye? Remember The Catcher in the Rye, when the catcher is in the rye field, sees all the kids running across, and the rye field's on the edge of a cliff, right? And you're trying to rescue those people from going over a cliff. That's what the catcher's doing in the story. I assign the abolition of man as a type of catcher in the rye trying to rescue my students before they go off into all sorts of intellectual foolishness. So that's at least why I assign the abolition of man. But notice what Lewis is doing here. Lewis is saying there's a doctrine of creation here. The world is so created and things are so structured that when you encounter the world, there is a proper way to relate to the world and an improper way to relate to the world. When you see something beautiful, we should recognize it as beautiful. And when we see something as ugly, we should recognize it as ugly. Because for Lewis, beauty's not in the eye of the beholder, right? The world is structured a certain way. And for Lewis, education is coming into contact with reality and learning how to love what you ought to love, how to love it in the right way, and how to hate what you ought to hate. Those aren't just constructions, haphazard constructions that we impose on reality. But reality draws those properly from us, and good, true education is to cultivate, I'm trying to cultivate in Caleb, Daniel, and Victoria to love the things they ought to love them the right way, and to hate the things they ought to hate. This is why Lewis quotes Plato's Republic. The well-nurtured youth is one, quote, who would see most clearly whatever was amiss in ill-made works of man or ill-grown works of nature, and with a just distaste would blame and hate the ugly even from his earliest years, and would give delighted praise to the beauty, receiving it into his soul and being nourished by it, so that he becomes a man of gentle heart. All this before he is of an age to reason, so that when reason at length comes to him, then bred as he has been, he will hold out his hands and welcome and recognize her because of the affinity he bears to her. And Lewis knows exactly what he is doing. To speak of the affections and sentiments being proper or just implies that there really is some external standard which stands over me and to which I must bow. In short, there is an objective value which is real and which is not my own making. It is a structure of value which is really there, which ought to be received, and it is not something I make up or construct. Lewis writes, "It is the doctrine of objective value, the belief that certain attitudes are really true and others really false, to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are." So for Lewis, learning is not simply about the head. It is no less than that. But it is not simply that. As Lewis writes, the heart never takes the place of the head, but it can and should obey it. As Lewis sees it, there are really only two options. Either, number one is engaged in the educational project, standing within the Tao, or let's just say for now, natural law, or the things we all know are right and true. So you're either standing within that, or one is engaged in the educational project standing outside of the Tao or natural law. But if one really does not affirm the Tao, that is, objective value and morality, which can be truly known, then one has cut oneself off from all objective value and morality whatsoever. So here's a lengthy quote from Lewis. He writes, "Hence the educational problem is wholly different according as you stand within or without the Tao. For those within, the task is to train in the pupil those responses which are in themselves appropriate, whether anyone is making them or not, and in making which the very nature of man consists. Those without it, if they are logical, must regard all sentiments as equally non-rational, as mere mists between us and the real objects. As a result, they must either decide to remove all sentiments as far as possible from the pupil's mind, because they can't be defended rationally, or else to encourage some sentiments for reasons that have nothing to do with their intrinsic justness or ordinancy. The latter course involves them in the questionable process of creating in others by suggestion or incantation a mirage which their own reason has successfully dissipated." So Gaius and Titius are in a bind. If they do want to inculcate a value, they cannot do so consistently out of a commitment to objective truth and morality, for they have no such commitment, right? Thus, if they do want to inculcate a value, they have to do so for some other reason. And here is the bind. They must try and inculcate a value when they, in fact, have no belief in values. That is, Gaius and Titius, one, must go the whole way, this is a quote from Lewis, must go the whole way and debunk this sentiment like any other, or two, must set themselves to work to produce from outside a sentiment which they believe to be of no value to the pupil and which may cost him his life because it is useful to us, the survivors or conditioners, that our young men should feel it, okay? So Lewis summarizes the problem. Were the old initiated, the new merely conditions. The old dealt with its pupil as grown birds deal with young birds when they teach them to fly. The new deals with them more as the poultry keeper deals with young birds. And I don't think Lewis was accidentally choosing the image of carving up meat, right, for sale to eat. I think that was very intentional. The new deals with them more as the poultry keeper deals with young birds, making them thus or thus for purposes of which the birds know nothing. They're about to be destroyed and eaten. In a word, the old was a kind of propagation. The men transmitting manhood to men. The new is merely propaganda. And here at the heart of the book is education has to do with bringing about in our students the proper sentiments. To do that, you have to have a belief in objective value. If you've given up belief in objective value, you either should be consistent and jettison all value whatsoever. We might think of postmoderns like Nietzsche or Foucault, who were more consistent with their presuppositions. They denied the possibility of meaning, and they tried to live their lives in light of that. But if you're going to not believe in objective value of morality, then when you sneak one in, we should think, well, why are you sneaking in a value? Your system says you can't have value. So why are you sneaking in a value here to impose upon us, right? Okay. So Lewis writes here, "The head rules the belly through the chest." And the chest here is Lewis's notion of the right sentiments, okay? "The head rules the belly through the chest, the seat, as Alanus tells us, of magnanimity, of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiment." The chest, magnanimity, sentiment, these are the indispensable liaison offers between the cerebral man and the visceral man. It may even be said that it is by this middle element that man is man. For by his intellect he is mere spirit, and by his appetite, mere animal. The whole trajectory of the influence of Gaius and Titius is to make men without chests. the title of the first lecture or chapter. Gaius and Titius are not more intellectual because they reject ultimate and objective values and morality. Quite the contrary. Because they reject ultimate and objective value and morality, this has a deleterious effect on their educational endeavor. That is, their rejection of the centrality of the chest, proper affections, actually means their quest for knowledge will become derailed. So we end up with the great quote from the end of the first chapter of The Abolition of Man. And all the time, such is the tragic comedy of our situation, we continue to clamor for those very qualities we are rendering impossible. You can hardly open a periodical without coming across the statement that what our civilization needs is more drive, or dynamism, or self-sacrifice, or creativity. In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chest and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. Okay? All right. Next theme from Lewis, the whole relationship of man and nature, which was somewhat alluded to in Jennifer's talk and Dr. Bernard's comments. So man and nature. The last, and this is from the last chapter of The Abolition of Man. It is this last chapter that where Lewis works out the frightening and insidious nature of an education not rooted in the Tao. And if you've ever read this book, the first time you read it, you may have thought, Lewis seems to me to be something of a radical. Like this could almost be out of the X-Files. You've got this cultural elite who are trying to shape all the future generations. It almost has a sci-fi dystopian feel when you read it. Having rejected any kind of objective order morality, this new cultured elite, which Lewis calls the conditioners, nonetheless are trying to form something. But since they do not, in fact, believe in any sort of ultimate moral order, this formation of the person is not in accord with any sort of accepted and objective moral norm. As Lewis writes, when all that says it is good has been debunked, what says I want remains. In other words, once you lose any sort of objective standard, this is really true, this is really the way things are, all you're left with is, I want something, right? That's all you're left with. Lewis was here perhaps more prescient than he could have imagined. This is exactly what we have seen in the last several decades from the various postmodernists like Derrida and Foucault, who in their own way harken back to Friedrich Nietzsche. I want rule supreme. Lewis contends that as each generation of conditioners shapes and molds the next generation, and as the conditioners debunk objective morality and goodness along the way, these conditioners are cutting off the young from the Tao itself. And then recently conditioned generations, that generation trains the next generation to reject the Tao or the natural law or natural moral order. As Lewis sees it, this is the abolition of man. The ability of one generation to shape the following generation so as to loosen or unhinge these following generations from any meaningful relationship to objective morality and truth. Lewis writes, it is in man's power to treat himself as a mere natural object and his own judgment of value as raw material for scientific manipulation to alter at will. Lewis goes on, the real objection is that if man chooses to treat himself as raw material he will be, not raw material to be manipulated, as he finally imagined, by himself, but by mere appetite, that is, mere nature in the person of his dehumanized conditioners. As Lewis sees it, there are two real options. Either we are a rational spirit obliged forever to obey the absolute values of the Tao, or else we are mere nature to be kneaded and cut into new shapes for the pleasure of masters who must, by hypothesis, have no motive but their own natural impulses. Okay? If you've never read The Abolition of Man skip my class, maybe not Bernard's class, and just go get the book and get your coffee and read it. It's one of those, you know, don't leave school until you've read it books, okay? I want to shift now into some other writings by Lewis. So next theme, C.S. Lewis and the reading of the old books. C.S. Lewis and the reading of the old books. Lewis was committed to what Thomas Aquinas had called centuries earlier the truth of things and what others have called the permanent things. Lewis at one point could save himself and his colleagues in terms of what they could provide for college students. We have fulfilled our whole function if we help you see some given tract of reality. Lewis was quite concerned and agitated about the educational movements of his own day. He believed that by the time a student went to college or university, you should have been trained that such that it is time for you to venture to look on reality in the raw. Lewis understood that learning is about the human person, you and me, coming into contact with reality. Nothing else will do. So as Lewis sees it, the student must indeed be a voracious reader if he wants to be learned. The student must read old books, not because no good books are being written today, but because the books written recently have not proved the test of time. But why read really, according to Lewis? If we're not careful, we may be tempted to think that we read lots of old books simply to drop the names, right? I read Plato yesterday. Oh, yeah? Well, I read Plato and Aristotle. Give me a break. I read Plato, Aristotle, and Thucydides. Yeah? Well, I read Plato, Aristotle, Thucydides, and I walked on the moon, right? So you get into this constant one-upmanship, right? You get the picture. But listen to what Lewis says about the importance of reading. We read the old books to guard ourselves from error. Lewis writes, every age has its own outlook. It is specially good at seeing certain truths and specially liable to make certain mistakes. We all, therefore, need the books that will correct the characteristic mistakes of our own period. And that means the old books. See, for Lewis, you can be devoted to the Western tradition, but not think the Western tradition always got it right. This is a bigger discussion, but you can advocate the privileging of the Western tradition on a college campus and still believe the Western tradition has some stuff that's, you know, not all that pleasant, right? But we read because the intellectual life is a moral enterprise. And unless we read, we are prone to go off the rails. We will not understand God, nor his world, nor our neighbor. We will assuredly find it difficult to love God and neighbor if we really don't know much about either. Next point, on reading correctly. So not just reading old books, but on reading correctly. Lewis encourages readers to read the old books, and he also encourages readers to learn how to read rightly or correctly. In his experiment in criticism, which should arguably be required reading for every freshman, Lewis discusses how to read. Lewis writes, now the reader reads every work seriously in the sense that he reads it wholeheartedly, makes himself as receptive as he can. But for that reason, he cannot possibly read every work solemnly or gravely. The good reader must get oneself out of the way. As Lewis writes, the first demand any work of any art makes upon us is surrender. Look, listen, receive. Perhaps most importantly, the good reader must receive what he reads and not simply use it. The good reader attends to what is before him and tries to receive what is being read on his own terms. There's an ethics of reading here. It is not that judgment is postponed indefinitely. It's not. It is simply that the good reader is not particularly antsy to judge. He's not in a hurry. The good reader is an ethical reader, a moral reader. The good reader takes words seriously and attempts to look through the words to see what can be seen. Then here's some Lewis humor. As Lewis writes, we can never know that a piece of writing is bad unless we've begun by trying to read it as if it were good and ended by discovering that we were paying the author an undeserved compliment. So you may get there, take your time getting to the critique. Next theme, the student as apologist. This is common in learning in wartime. We learn and read for a reason. Students are, in a sense, being trained and shaped so they can be one of the Dunedain from The Lord of the Rings. The Dunedain are a race of men who guard places like the Shire from evil creatures and forces springing forth from Mordor. Simple creatures like hobbits may mock the Dunedain, if you recall from the first of the trilogy, but it is the Dunedain who are guarding and protecting the hobbits from evil. Thus, there is a moral and apologetical purpose in learning, as Lewis writes. If all the world were Christian, it might not matter if all the world were uneducated. But as it is, a cultural life will exist outside the church, whether it exists inside or not. To be ignorant and simple now, not to be able to meet the enemies on their own ground, would be to throw down our weapons and to betray our uneducated brethren who have under God no defense but us against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered. And he continues, the cool intellect must work not only against the cool intellect on the other side, but against the muddy heathen mysticisms which deny intellect altogether. That may be almost our problem more today, is the possibility of knowledge, right? You see what Lewis is saying? It is no accident that Lewis and Tolkien were friends. Both ultimately were men of the Dunedain. Both were attempting to resist and speak up against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Both saw themselves as fulfilling a moral duty to help their brothers and sisters in Christ who, for whatever reason, did not have the education and the intellectual prowess they both possessed. Last theme, the importance of the past. Lewis was adamant that to be educated meant to attend to the past. Lewis saw himself as a representative of old Western culture, capital O, capital W, capital C. In his inaugural lecture upon assuming the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge in 1954, he could say of the past, it is not the remembered but the forgotten past that enslaves us. Indeed, to study the past does indeed liberate us from the present, from the idols of our own marketplace, but I think it also liberates us from the past too. I think no class of men are less enslaved to the past than historians. The unhistorical are usually, without knowing it, enslaved to a fairly recent past. That is, as the heirs of Western culture, if we want to be educated, we must be steeped and immersed in the Western intellectual tradition. There is no other path to being educated. The Western tradition may, like the Clint Eastwood movie of several decades ago, be marked by the good, the bad, and the ugly, but nonetheless, it is our tradition. And to be educated means to know from whence we have come. In conclusion, it would have been good to trace out many more themes, and there are many more on C.S. Lewis and education. We have been largely positive in attempting to summarize some of his insights. He was indeed an intellectual dinosaur. He has mediated to many of us an older Western tradition worthy of recovery and attention. And when you are surrounded by decay and incoherence, attention to dinosaurs may be just what is needed. Alistair MacIntyre once quipped that since we live in an age when the barbarians are not only at the gate but are running the show, we may need to look for a new Saint Benedict. Perhaps we do, but I think a new C.S. Lewis or two would help us as well. Thank you.